Hello, welcome to the House of Comments podcast. This is a regular podcast featuring me, Mark Thompson, Lib Dem blogger, and also regularly featuring my co-host, and as she described me last week when she was hosting, sidekick, Emma Burnell, who is a Labour blogger. Good evening, Emma.
Hi, Mark. I knew that would come back on me.
It's bound to, and I'm going to keep saying it now. And also, we're delighted to be joined this evening by Raphael Baer, who is political editor of The New Statesman. Good evening, Raphael.
Good evening.
Right. So we thought we would start with the political story that's pretty much dominated the coverage for the last couple of weeks, really, but particularly since we had the result, which is the Eastleigh by-election, where the Lib Dems did hold on just about to the seat. But the majority was cut quite significantly. But the story that seems to have been picked up most is the fact that UKIP came second with 28% of the vote. Lib Dems got 32%, UKIP 28%, and the Conservatives were pushed into third place with 25% of the vote. So what do we think about this? Raphael, do you think this is a pretty seismic event? Do you think it's as seismic as lots of people are saying?
Well, it's certainly significant, isn't it? I mean, you always have to have the caveat, don't you, that by-elections don't tell you as much about what's going to happen at the next general election as everyone sort of wishes they would. They tend to be a bit peculiar. I do think it's interesting. You said that the story that everyone really seemed to latch onto was that UKIP came second. And that's true in the media presentation of it. But you'll probably like this, Mark. I think that's a bit harsh on the Lib Dems. I think the Lib Dems, the actual story is that the Lib Dems held the seat. I mean, the winner of the contest on the night was the Lib Dem candidate, not the UKIP candidate. And that in itself is very significant because I think two thirds of Lib Dem seats are thereabouts are Tory facing. A good between 20 and 40 of the seats the Tories really want to win at the next election are currently held by Lib Dems. And if the Lib Dem organisation on the ground is so well dug in and entrenched that they can just see off quite a significant, powerful, expensive campaigning effort by the Conservative Party, well, that makes it very difficult for David Cameron to win the majority in the next election. And it gives the Lib Dems, when their national poll rating is in the dire state, quite a lot of hope. So I think actually that should be easily as big a story as UKIP coming second.
What do you think, Emma?
Yes, no. I think that the Lib Dems did really, really well in a by-election, and that's something Lib Dems are very, very good at. I think translating that to what will happen in 2015 is more tough than that, though. I think it's interesting because it does seem to be the case that the Labour vote will still vote Lib Dem against to keep a Tory out, but the Lib Dem vote dropped by 14%. It actually dropped more than it did in Rotherham. It just that it didn't drop as much as their nearest competitors, so they managed to hold on to the seat. So I think there is a real danger that some people could get a little overexcited. I think Tim Farron's, we're going to win 30 more seats.
I'd agree. I mean, bear in mind also, sort of supporting that point, Emma, that it's very hard for the Tories to get protest votes when there's a Conservative Prime Minister sitting in number 10. So actually what you are really asking the Tories to do, which is to win a by-election as essentially the most prominent incumbent governing party, that doesn't actually happen very often. And so obviously there were going to be a whole bunch of people who were just protest voting or angry about the general state of affairs. It is significant that they didn't think that Labour was the place to put that vote. And it is significant that enough of them, and that, as I said, Lib Dem machine could persuade enough people to stick with the incumbent party on the ground. But it was actually, looking back on it, quite a big ask to think the Tories could actually win it.
Yeah, I agree. But I think they should have come second. And I think that they know that and they are quite worried about that. But I don't think it blows completely out of the water their 40-40 strategy, because too many Lib Dem seats that they have to gain to get a majority government are actually quite tight. I mean, if you look at the swing that you'd need in Solihull or in Mid Dorset and North Pool, they're tiny, tiny swings.
But also, but to interrupt, I think, sorry, but I think also Labour probably learned something in this contest as well, and they wanted to test the ground. Could they nab votes in the South? I think in the general election campaign, my gut feeling is that Labour will more or less cede some of those southwest voters to the Lib Dems if it really is a Lib Dem Tory contest.
And I think that's right, but I think that whether or not that will be enough I think I think Labour voters will hold their nose and vote Lib Dem when it's a Lib Dem Tory marginal. Whether enough of them, where these tiny, tiny swings are required, will do so is I think, the question. And whether that will balance people who might vote UKIP in a by-election returning to the Conservatives in the general election.
I don't know, is the answer.
Yeah.
No, that is a very big question, isn't it? Whether those UKIP people are people who, as it were, come home to a mainstream party on general election night, or whether actually something more profound has happened to the electoral terrain and they're lost to sort of, it's a sort of a Tea Party tendency, they're lost to normal mainstream politics as we've known it in previous elections. Yeah. And no one knows the answer to that.
I think that's an important point that you made a bit earlier, Emma, about how the Lib Dems are still able to pick up Labour votes. They are still able to squeeze that Labour vote. And because I think there's been a bit of a feeling in the last year or two that the ability to do that has diminished to almost nothing. And actually, we saw in Eastleigh that it is still possible to do that. So I think that's an important thing that we've learned. And I think, just coming back to what you said, Raphael, thank you for pointing out that we did win and underlining that, because it is true. And I mean, I blogged about this the other day, and I did say that it is typical of quite a lot of the mainstream media that, you know, as soon as the Lib Dems have won, they just go very quiet. They've been very vocal, very loud about the Lib Dems in the last couple of weeks and all the accusations that have been flying around. But as soon as they win a by-election, it's all suddenly shifted onto UKIP, and Lib Dems hardly seem to get a mention on the front pages.
Nobody thinks winning is a story, though, generally. Yeah. I don't think that's a specifically Lib Dem targeted issue.
Absolutely. I'm not saying that we're being picked on. I'm saying the media have their own agenda and they'll follow it come what may. And basically,
and in support of that, you have to consider what would happen if had the Lib Dems lost it, and you've got Spring Conference coming up, and there would have been a whole bunch of people saying, well, clearly this is free fall and Clegg's position in doubt. So the stakes were high enough that it is still a story that element of it was sort of closed down by holding the seat.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think just coming to the UKIP factor, I mean, my feeling is that this is actually a very significant political occurrence here, that UKIP have come second. And they actually, when you look at it, ran the Lib Dems quite close. I mean, if things had been a bit different, if maybe there hadn't been as many postal votes, if the campaign had run for another week, actually, we could be looking at the first UKIP MP here. It was pretty close. And I don't think we should underestimate what they've managed to achieve, because this is a party that didn't even exist 20 years ago. And in our electoral system, it is very, very difficult for small parties, you know, insurgent parties, to make the kind of headway to get to the point where they can start getting MPs. And UKIP have come close. And I wrote about this the other day, that I think that we're in a situation now where the next time there's a by-election, or even when it comes to the general election, the argument on the doorstep that the Conservatives will try to deploy, that a UKIP vote is a wasted vote and UKIP can't win, and, you know, you need to vote Conservative, to come back to what you were saying about, you know, whether the UKIP voters will come home. I think that message is going to be harder and harder to sell, because people will know. I mean, there's been a lot of publicity about this. People know UKIP came close. But lots of the headlines say UKIP beat the Conservatives. I mean, it almost sounds like, when you read the headlines, they won the seat. And that's the kind of message that resonates and cuts through, and that people will remember.
And so, also, as any statistician will tell you, I mean, you look at the trend rather than the moment, and all of the by-elections recently, UKIP have done better than they did in the 2010. And they're obviously taking votes from all over the place. So I agree, to the extent that I think that whatever it is that's animating people to walk into a ballot box and put the cross by the UKIP logo, it expresses something a little bit more profound about their alienation from the other parties than perhaps went into the kind of midterm by-election protest vote in previous years.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of other factors as well that are worth bearing in mind as well here, though. I mean, the first one is that UKIP actually very strongly focused on local issues in this by-election. That's not something they've been particularly well known for in the past. Now, I haven't studied the nature of the campaigns that closely, so I might be doing them a disservice here, but in Eastleigh...
Oh, don't do them a disservice, it's UKIP, let's not be too...
All right, okay. Well, in Eastleigh, they really did focus on local issues. That was one of the things they were pushing quite hard. And that suggests to me that they're maturing as a political party. I mean, that's something that the Lib Dems have always been very good at in local elections, focusing on local issues. The fact that UKIP are now picking up on that and following that, because really, they tend to be known for a couple of things, don't they? They want to come out of Europe, they're not happy about immigration, and more recently, they don't want equal marriage. You know, those kind of national issues. But actually, when it comes to local elections and local by-elections, it is often the local issues that win the day. And the other thing is that the candidate that they chose, by all accounts, was actually very good and very
that's
strong.
That's a very important point, because actually, I'm sorry, I'm cutting across you, but to be quick, the problem that UKIP has is, you know, getting the staff. I mean, Nigel Farage is quite an effective performer and comes across as sort of genial, affable, nice bloke down the pub, bit of a saloon bar bore sometimes, but you know, he obviously resonates with some people. Their MEPs have been an absolute catastrophe. I mean, a bunch of them resigned, a couple of them, you know, for sort of what looked like quasi-criminal activity. I wouldn't want to libel them, so I'm sure they're not guilty of many of the things they're accused of. But either way, it's pretty clear that UKIP struggles to get professional, credible candidates in at a level sufficient to really look like a national political organisation. Now, if that changes, if they're recruiting people who can stand as prospective candidates who look really serious and credible, who look more like professional Tories than Maria Hutchings did on the ground in Eastleigh, then that is a significant kind of maturing of them as a political organisation. I haven't yet seen much evidence that that's actually happening.
Yeah, I mean, it maybe isn't as widespread as they would like, but I wonder if maybe there'll be a couple of effects here. I mean, like I say, I do think Diane James was a very credible candidate. But also, if they're starting to come close, they're starting to look like they might be able to win, then maybe people who would be credible candidates will actually feel like they can stand for them. Although, just to counter this slightly, on the night of the by-election on Question Time, they put up Neil Hamilton, which I think doesn't tell a very good story. I was looking at it thinking, why is this political retread on here representing UKIP? You know, they need to do better than that. Sorry, Emma.
Yeah, and I think there is the other side of that coin, though, that the more that they look credible and become part of the national story, the more the spotlight will be on them. And I think that lots of people have learned from what happened to the Liberal Democrats when they had lots of things that they were promising in opposition that they couldn't deliver either in government or possibly even if they'd had a majority government. I think that the media have probably learnt from that as much as the political parties have in terms of the scrutiny that UKIP will get for its policies, which are hard to add up to one coherent whole. Whether that matters a lot, I don't think it does when you are the protest vote, the anti-politics vote. A lot of people are pissed off with just politics as a whole, the way that government works in general, whoever party it is, the government always wins. And that's very significant in by-elections, but it's not to be discounted at general elections. And there are people willing to go out of their house and go to the polling station and make that statement. And if enough of them do that for UKIP, if enough of them find UKIP the vehicle with which to do that, then they will have a significant impact on elections. They just won't necessarily have an impact in terms of getting their own MPs elected, and that may well be better for them in the long run, because at the moment I don't think they have a policy platform on which they can coherently run things. And I think we've seen that with the way, as Raphael was saying, that they have kind of collapsed in on themselves in Europe, because they're not very coherent in actually having a way of engaging positively with politics rather than negatively.
I agree with a lot of that. I would be a little bit wary of some wishful thinking in terms of hoping that a bit of scrutiny will see them collapse and fold for two reasons. One, I mean, as a political journalist, I don't have, unfortunately, much estimation for the role that political journalism plays in actually scrutinising policies very well. I wish it did that more and better. But actually, I mean, people can get by with flaky policies that don't add up for quite a long time. And in fact, actually, the Labour Party at the moment is doing rather well with a policy platform that doesn't stand up to too much scrutiny. And the other point about this sort of populist, nationalist, anti-establishment, if you can call it that, anti-politics parties like UKIP, if you look at the game they've played, equivalent parties have played on continental Europe, you know, the Freedom Party or the Vlaams Blok, what they are very good at doing when they come under attack for not having coherent policies. He's saying, well, the mainstream establishment elite media would say that, wouldn't they? This just goes to reinforce that actually we're the only outsiders speaking the truth, and there's a conspiracy to silence us or to go against us. So it can sort of becomes a self-reinforcing story that the more you come after them, the more they sort of martyr themselves in the public eye and look like the exact appropriate place for a protest vote to go. So they can, I reckon they can surf this for quite a long time, possibly.
Oh, I agree. They can surf this level of it for quite a long time. I just don't see where they go from here. And where I don't know how they make the leap to the next level. And I mean, I can see them being the Green Party of the right and having a few strongholds, getting a few councillors on the ground, making a few inroads in a few places. I don't see them becoming a party of national government in the way that, say, the Lib Dems have, or Plaid Cymru, or the SNP have, both in their nations and also have the possibility of doing in the hung parliament in future.
Yeah, I think, just coming back to what Raphael said there about the media not being great at focusing on policy scrutiny. And it takes me back to what happened just before the general election in 2010, which was that Clegg had his, you know, what I've heard referred to as the Cleggasm of his, you know, his first performance in the leaders' debate. And then suddenly there was, you know, a lot of talk about the Lib Dem surge, and, you know, they were going up in the polls. And then people were saying, ah, but you're going to get scrutiny now. And then what happened was there was scrutiny, and it was scrutiny of Clegg's wife, the fact that he spoke, you know, several different languages, the fact that, you know, his parents were from different countries. You know, the focus was on silly stuff that didn't really seem to make much sense in terms of what people should be voting.
Also, quite a lot of focus on the amnesty for illegal immigrants,
yeah,
as a sort of a policy that the Daily Mail found loathsome. So they found something to attach to. I think the what will be different for UKIP is that there is sort of between 40 and 80 perhaps Tory MPs who think that UKIP is sort of on a political continuum with the Conservative Party, and as it were needs to be sort of brought back to the mothership, much as some Labour MPs or Labour members sort of mistakenly for a long time saw the Lib Dems as sort of the Labour people who kind of got lost in sort of Battlestar Galactica style, so their sort of spaceship off, you know, somewhere in the wrong bit of the galaxy, and just needed to come back to the home planet and rejoin the Labour movement. Now I think that opinion has shifted a bit. But as long as you've got the Conservative Party there normalising and legitimising UKIP as essentially the Conservative Party in exile, they will have that credibility and that authority, which I frankly don't think they deserve. And I think there is actually now a moral obligation on the Conservatives to lead the process of exposing UKIP as not having, you know, a credible platform to stand on, because the Tories can make those arguments much better, I think, on things like immigration when they're speaking to that audience than Labour or the Lib Dems could.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, isn't it? Because I think you're right. I think there are quite a lot of backbench Tories who feel, let's be honest, a closer affinity with UKIP and their policy platform than they do with their own policy platform. I think there is conferred on them a level of legitimacy from the right of the Tory party. I think Farage and the leadership of UKIP would be crazy to do anything that would smack of a deal with the Conservatives, you know, whether it's any kind of informal deal or formal deal, you know, to win them a few seats. I think they can ride this insurgency wave now, and I don't think that they'll be too worried about what focus might be on their policies, because I think they can ride this quite a long way. And I'd actually be surprised if in the next 2 or 3 years they don't win a by-election somewhere. I think they're now capable of doing that. And they may even pick up, you know, some seats at the general election. I think what's happened has been that significant that actually could happen. I don't underestimate the task involved, you know, and Farage tried in Buckingham, didn't he, in 2010, and he came third. You know, he didn't even come second, and that was when that was when it was against the Speaker, and really should have had a pretty clear run at it. But I think things have changed. I felt the tectonic plate shift on Thursday.
I think they could win a by-election. I think if this Andrew Mitchell story, the idea that he is going to go off to the EU and then there'd be a by-election in his seat in 2014, I think they could well, if they play that right, if they run Diane James rather than Nigel Farage, I think they could easily pick up that seat, and that could be very, very interesting. General election, I don't know, because I think they have the same problem that I foresee for the Lib Dems in the general election, which is that they're not pouring all their now more limited resources into one seat, they're trying to cover, you know, all the seats in the country. And that's a lot harder, and they're being squeezed out of a national conversation as well as the conversations in every single locality. That's where I think they will have trouble. I think when it's a by-election and they get to share the coverage and share the excitement and be part of and pour every activist in the country into that by-election, that's a lot easier situation to win than trying to do it during a general election.
Mm.
That's a very good point, I think. I mean, and the money issue, exactly. No, I don't have anything to add to that. I think you're absolutely right. It'll be very hard. You know, what kind of seat actually in the general election is UKIP winning? We don't know. And if they get in, if they nick in a by-election between now and the general election, what will be interesting is the pressure once they're represented in Parliament and doing well in the polls, do well in June 2014 European elections. To be included in leader debates. So what actually one of the impacts of UKIP search could be to kill leader debates in the 2015 general election.
Yeah, that will be very interesting to watch, actually, because I've wondered that as well. I think the arguments for not including Nigel Farage in those debates are becoming thinner and thinner when you look at the polls and you look at how well they're doing. OK, they don't have parliamentary representation yet. But yeah, I think that's going to be an interesting argument. And yeah, I hadn't really thought of that it might actually ultimately mean they don't happen because it becomes too complicated and the rest of the parties object. And in the end, it just, you know, like we've seen many other times.
Greens, because the Greens will then turn around and say, well, we may not be polling as high, but we have an MP.
Yeah, exactly. We have an MP. Yeah.
And then you've just got a free for all.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just wanted to try and pick up another strand of the fallout from Eastleigh, which is John O'Farrell wrote a piece for The Guardian where he talked about his experiences. And I mean, it's clear that it was pretty bruising for him and pretty horrible to have, you know, some of the stuff that was said about him splashed all over the front cover of some of the newspapers in this country, talking about, you know, the comments that he'd made in his book, Things Can Only Get Better, which we talked about on this podcast a couple of weeks ago. And I personally felt that, you know, that should not be focused on at all. You know, he made those comments when he was basically a kid and he was just very honest about them. But obviously other people took a different view. But he's decided now that he doesn't want to stand as a candidate basically ever again. He said certainly not in 2015. And Mark Ferguson wrote a piece for Labour List, which was lamenting that. But also lamenting more broadly that we're reaching a point now where basically anyone who's ever said or done anything controversial that will be dredged up, used against them. And really, we're just going to end up in 20 years' time with a bunch of automatons who've never said or done anything controversial. Basically, just a bunch of bland people who are kind of politics safe because they've never said anything that's controversial at all. Emma, what do you think about this?
Yeah, I think, I think that's one of the best. I'm a big fan of Mark Ferguson's writing. I'm a big fan of Mark Ferguson. He's a very good friend of mine. I think that's one of the best things he's ever written because he's quite right. And it is terrifying. I mean, I have been a member of the Labour Party since I was 15 years old. There are few people more dedicated than me to the Labour project, to success for the Labour Party. I wouldn't stand in a by-election to save my life. I wouldn't do it for all the tea in China, even though I don't drink tea. But, you know, I don't think that's the point. Although that would be something I'd get picked up on, wouldn't I?
You don't drink tea, you're not properly British.
I'm not British enough. Yeah, because I've had a life, as well as being a Labour Party activist, I've had a life and it's been fun. And you know what? I'm not ashamed of it, but I have also been open and honest about it. And why on earth would I put myself through 3 weeks of hell simply for being the kind of human being people always say they want to see elected?
Yeah. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think we're in danger of sort of violently agreeing with each other on this one. I mean, I feel strongly about this. I thought John O'Farrell's piece was very good. I haven't read Mark's piece. I will do. It sounds like I would agree with it and enjoy it. I mean, it is profoundly depressing, obviously, that having a sort of original, characterful voice and, you know, something in your past that is at sort of best idiosyncratic, at worst embarrassing, might preclude you from public office. You see, it's appalling. You see MPs, even I've been in the lobby for a couple of years, I got to know some of the MPs who were elected in 2010, and already you can see the process by which some of the ones who really enjoy having a bit of character and a bit of life, either they decide to become perpetual backbenchers because they can't bear to have their character sort of annihilated by party machine, or they're already thinking of leaving, or they are sort of submitting themselves to the robotification, the sort of becoming the Borg of politics. So that's my second sci-fi reference.
I was just going to pick up on that, actually. I'm very pleased. Carry on.
But the... I would also point out, I'll just make a slightly more sort of partisan point here. Let's also remember that George Osborne is Chancellor of the Exchequer and has been pictured in a tabloid newspaper sitting at a table with a sex worker on his lap and racked up lines of cocaine on the table in front of him. Now, the sort of, my imaginary lawyer on my left says, well, that, you know, there's all sorts of interpretations could be put on that picture. But nonetheless, it hasn't stopped the guy from becoming Chancellor of the Exchequer. There have been all sorts of discussions and allegations about the possibility of David Cameron having used or not used what we call controlled substances in the law. He is the Prime Minister. And so when someone has something in their past or there's some element of character, something they've said or done, and it is used against them, it is used against them in a very focused, specific media environment with a very specific agenda. Bluntly speaking, you know, it's the Mail that goes for people in this way, and sometimes with other newspapers cheering along on the side. But the Mail is a political institution as well as a newspaper with its own agenda. So let's not forget that, you know, exactly the forensic sort of element of this directed against certain candidates by a particular newspaper.
Yeah. I mean, it is the Mail that's most guilty of this, although it's not exclusively them. I mean, other newspapers do go for people as well. And actually what tends to happen is that it becomes a feeding frenzy, doesn't there? And even though the Mail might start something, other papers pick up on it, and even broadcast media picks up on these stories, and it goes through the blogosphere. Exactly.
So, you know, reporting.
Yeah, once it's been on the front cover of the Mail, it's open season for everyone to comment on it then, isn't it? And I mean, that does happen. And I've seen it time and again where you see, you know, candidates or MPs, and something is discovered about them from their past, and, you know, and they're absolutely trashed and they're dragged through the mud. And actually, it's not just MPs. I remember David Nutt, who was the head of the ACMD, the Advisory Committee on the Misuse of Drugs. And when he was fired, it was then seen, it was perceived by some portions of the press, particularly the Mail and the Sun, that, you know, that he was fired because he basically was pro-drugs. He was, in their terms, pro-drugs. That he was, you know, he basically was trying to push legalization of drugs. And about a year after he was fired, there was a story in the Sun that had trawled Facebook to find pictures and stories about his children and what they had done. And in one case, there was a suggestion one of them had smoked cannabis, although it turned out there was no real evidence for that. And then there was another one that one of his daughters was drinking, I think, or supposedly drinking, and it was before her 18th birthday, so she's like 16 or 17. And then another of his children had been in Sweden and had been naked in a spa. And that was it. That was the story. And his kids were absolutely trash. This guy isn't even a politician. I mean, you know, they will just trash anyone, even the children of people. I mean, you know, it gets absolutely ridiculous. And there's not really any answer to that stuff. I mean, I had hoped that Leveson was going to do something to stop this sort of thing, although, as we've discussed again on this podcast previously, it's kind of looking like, well, Leveson, certainly any kind of statute isn't going to be there. Just to come back to the whole public life thing.
They're taking drugs in the Last Chance Saloon once again.
Yeah, well, what I actually wonder, we might find there's actually an effect that's the opposite of what we're fearing here, which is that, I mean, we all, I presume we're all roughly the same age. I'm in my late 30s. So I didn't grow up. The internet didn't exist when I was a kid and when I was in my youthful 20s doing silly things. So there aren't really any pictures out there of me saying or doing stupid things. I haven't written things that have gone online. I mean, I know Owen Jones got picked up for something that he wrote when he was 16 last year. But, you know, what he said was a bit silly and intemperate. I can't remember the details of it now. But, you know, 16-year-olds say stupid things. They shouldn't be held to account for them when they're 28 years old like he is now. You know, that's just absolutely ridiculous. But I wonder if we might see an opposite effect, which is that basically in 20 years' time, everyone who is an up-and-coming potential MP will have something embarrassing about them. And you'll almost have just a levelling effect where everyone's got it and it will no longer be a story because it will just, you know, everyone will be in exactly the same boat. Whereas at the moment, what you've got is one generation that didn't have this, who've sort of got away with it, and the upcoming generation who kind of can be got with this stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting that I'm just trying to think about how this all plays out, because I mean, obviously there's an element of sort of mutually assured destruction, as you say, if everyone's got stuff floating around about them online. But at the same time, you know, what are the circumstances in which this stuff gets mobilized against someone and not? I mean, again, I'm thinking of someone like Boris Johnson, who gets away with all sorts of things. I mean, you can have a certain kind of candidate, you know, off whom this stuff just bounces. I think the sort of to try and focus in on where it becomes problematic politically at the moment, as long as there is more generally a culture of fear of the gaffe, and I sense this when I, you know, in a professional capacity, if you're interviewing people, I mean, there is a whole, you can feel the caution. People who don't necessarily feel the confidence that someone like Boris does to express themselves in their own words, as soon as the tape recorder is on, they lapse into a kind of a particular idiom of bleached out, bland, meaningless sort of phraseology. That's not fear of having, you know, taken drugs or done something reckless in your past. That's fear of just a slightly misturned metaphor turning into a gaffe that's embarrassing. I can't think of any examples off the top of my head, but people saying perfectly innocent things. Or you take the example of, you know, Hilary Mantel writing a perfectly interesting and sensible piece in the London Review of Books that, for absolutely no apparent reason, as far as I can make out, gets turned into a row about the Middletons, and on which both the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition had to pass sort of vacuous, faux patriotic comment. I mean, it's faintly absurd. I'm now ranting, so I'll just stop.
Well, you say they had to. They didn't have to. They chose to.
Felt they had to, yeah.
Once they were asking Cameron the question in India over and over again, of course he had to respond. And once Cameron responded, of course Ed had to respond. And it's ridiculous, and it's so annoying and pointless and stupid. But it would have become the 5-day story that Cameron wouldn't comment to swoop in and save Kate if he hadn't taken that.
Are you sure about that? I mean, would it not? I mean, I wonder what would have happened if either of them had said, I haven't read the whole of Hilary Mantel's piece. She's one of our finest novelists. I'll give her the benefit of the doubt on this. I'm sure, actually, there was more to it than that. I mean, what actually would have happened if either of them had said it? I don't know the consensus. I know there were people in the shadow cabinet who think Ed was badly advised on that and that he should have not essentially demonstrated playing that game.
On that one. It would have been great. I think that there would have been enough stupid people making enough that he would have had nothing else to talk about for the next 4 days.
I think the problem we've got is, I don't want to blame this all on one person because it's a cultural problem. But, I do think Blair has a lot to answer for this because, you know, he just commented on everything and anything. You know, he commented on a fictional character in a soap opera, you know, getting out of prison. He felt like he had to stick his oar in when...
No, he commented on her being wrongly sent to prison.
Yeah, okay.
Speaks to Barlow one.
Yeah, he commented on whether the England football manager should have made some remarks that he shouldn't have done. But, you know, the Prime Minister shouldn't get involved in stuff like that. And, you know, it really has trivialised politics, I
think. Well, hang on a second, though, because... You're now saying Prime Minister shouldn't talk about culture and soap operas and football managers when what part of what we're worried about is these automatons who only stay on message all the time. Maybe talking about football or soap operas is actually kind of good.
No, because...
Maybe talking like ordinary people is a good thing.
No, because to come back to one of your favourite programmes, Emma, The West Wing, as Bartlett once said, he's a human starting gun. You know, if he makes a comment on something, that runs and runs and runs and it has effects. And that's exactly the case with the Prime Minister. If Prime Ministers make comments on things, then it fires a starting gun on a process that actually, in the case of the England football manager, eventually led to him having to go.
But it also led to Deirdre Barlow being released.
Well, that's true. So, you know, there's pluses and minuses.
The Blair thing, it's... Yeah, I think there was a problem in the way in that the communications heart of the New Labour project that can be seen as the kernel of something that certainly Cameron now feels obliged to continue because he saw how effective it was when you get it right. I think more, although, I mean, passing comment on popular culture, what other way do politicians have to somehow demonstrate that they do lead, you know, they do have lives that can resonate with the people who they're asking to vote for them? I mean, you have to. I mean, OK, so Ed Ball's says he gets a bit teary at the Antiques Roadshow. I mean, that's just plain bizarre. But, you know, in fairness, you know,
you can tell they didn't focus group it though.
No, but these people, exactly. I mean, you know, if he was that cynical, he wouldn't have said the Antiques Roadshow. But the these people, they do have to. It's not unreasonable to expect people to politicians to indicate somehow that they are in touch with the popular culture of the country that they want to govern. I think, yeah, there's lots of things getting bundled up here. I mean, the crucial thing is, can a candidate, can an MP or, you know, politician use their own voice, express themselves naturally in a relaxed way and without fear? And the answer is no, they can't. And the ones that do well are the ones who are just exceedingly good at it.
Yeah.
And actually, Boris Johnson is an example of that. The reason Boris has done well is he is very, very good at using his authentic Boris voice in actually what looks like a spontaneous way, but is actually meticulously crafted for effect and for the right moment. And that's, you know, he's a pro, and that's why he is, you know, having the political career he's having.
At the end of the day, I think that is key to it all. Not just whether they talk about popular culture, not just the way they talk about policy, not just their background, but I think it is about authenticity. And it's about whether you come out and say, I'm me, I have massive flaws, I'm totally a huge Buffy fan and will reference that in House of Commons if I ever get a chance. I also have no idea who One Direction are and couldn't pick Justin Bieber out of a lineup. And actually, if I'm honest about my cultural references and honest about, you know, I really like what Labour are doing on this, I question what they're doing on that, but, you know, that's not my area of policy. So I think it's just about being authentic with the message rather than simply trying to be as many things to as many people as humanly possible. And sometimes that means that you do reference a soap opera because that's what you do when you kick back at the end of a very, very long day in the Commons.
Yeah, but there's no way in the world that Tony Blair was following Coronation Street. So, someone told him to say that. But anyway, to move on from that particular one, it's very interesting what you said about Boris, actually, Raphael, because I think, I mean, maybe you're in a better position to judge this because, you know, you're in the lobby and, you know, you're probably closer to this. But I get the feeling with Boris, it's a combination of both manufactured and carefully crafted apparent spontaneity and also actual spontaneity. Because, I mean, for example, I heard him being interviewed on LBC a couple of weeks ago. And then Nick Ferrari asked him, are you going to go down to Easton? He said, yes, of course I am. Wild horses wouldn't keep you away. Of course I'm going to be going down there and pounding the streets. That's exactly what I need to do. And Ferrari said, OK, but in what way is you going down to Eastleigh helping the people of London? And he said, yes, that's a good point. I think I'll probably have to take it as a holiday. And it's like, you know, he didn't try and bluff it and try and pretend. It just looked like he hadn't really thought about that aspect of the question. And just off the top of his head said he'd take a day off. It didn't really feel manufactured. And he does things like that all the time. And it is like he can get away with it. Other politicians couldn't. You know, how many politicians get away with being suspended from a cable for 10 minutes and not come away from it looking absolutely ridiculous? Whereas with Boris, it didn't really matter. It was just a laugh, and he just moved on from it.
Yeah, I'd broadly agree with that, I think. But he has created a political persona over time, the part of which is the ability to do exactly the sort of thing you described there, you know, make mistakes, go back and stuff, contradict himself. It's partly luck, but it's mostly talent. I just think he's a very skillful politician. Doesn't mean I agree with what he does or like having him as mayor of the city I live in or think he should be leader of the Conservatives or prime minister, but I don't doubt that he is an immensely talented politician.
Yeah.
I think there is also an aspect to this about the way that different types of politician are portrayed. I think thinking particularly, like, if you think about interview pieces with politicians, and Raphael, you might be interested to comment. I mean, one of the things I always notice, if I read a profile piece on a politician, if it's a male politician, it will start with an action. You know, he picked up his newspaper and strode across the room. If it's a female politician, it will start with their appearance or something they say that's quite soft and unpolitical. And that sort of sets a tone. And again, I'm thinking because one of the other things that we were going to talk about was the sort of continuing fallout from the Renard allegations, that I think that, again, there is a women are expected to do X kind of social activities or speak about X kind of policy in X kind of way, whereas men might do a kind of different, you know, we have to reference guitar bands and we have to, you know, so actually Blair doing Coronation Street kind of crossed that divide a little bit, but that was Blair. But yeah, there again, it sets these particular parameters to which you're allowed to be a human being. And whether they are real or not, there is a way to be a female politician and set your parameters. And there's a way to be a male politician. You have your football team. Both sets seem to talk about X Factor, but that's beyond me.
I agree with that. I think it's very interesting. I mean, not necessarily about how we construct intros. I'm just mentally going through the sort of archive of interviews I've done. And I'm pleased to report that, from all I can recall off the top of my head, it definitely doesn't match the pattern that you describe. Nonetheless, I think it is true, certainly, that the politicians who have been able to sort of flesh out their political identity with all that sort of peripheral cultural stuff, it tends to be men, and for all sorts of reasons, and it's a subject of a whole podcast in its own right, it does seem to be harder for women in politics to do that. And I suspect that is partly because the level of potential hostility and sort of mistreatment at the hands of the press, and the way in which if a female politician sort of uses those sorts of references, that sort of cultural apparatus to describe her identity and her politics, it would lead to a kind of belittling and denigration and sort of patronizing attitude that would make her less substantial as a politician. That is a hazard that probably doesn't affect men so much, which is obviously desperately sad, but that would be one interpretation.
A good example. She gets a lot of stick for tweeting about indie guitar bands, which is something that, having known her for about a decade, she's really into. Tom Watson doesn't get that stick. You know, and it's you know, he's considered quite cool, and oh my gosh, isn't it interesting, this MP likes cool music. Whereas Stella, it's like, oh yeah, all right, pull the other one, love. And it's
really
just not...
I think that's a generation thing. I mean, certainly my colleagues, journalistic colleagues, and a lot of MPs from all parties, I think, quite admire Stella as someone who obviously stands out, you know, in this kind of conversation, as having an authentic voice and being able to do something very tricky, which is express her Labour values and her Labour policies in her own words, so not just parroting the sort of turgid phrase mongering from Labour headquarters, but without actually veering wildly off message or making the kind of gaffes that would become problematic for Ed and the leadership in the party. Now that's you know, that's skillful as politics.
And no, absolutely, and I think she is admired for that. I think it's the cultural stuff that people judge differently with her.
Oh yeah, I don't know. Because I don't judge it differently. I'm sort of disappointed to hear that people do, but it doesn't surprise me actually.
Maybe just in the last few minutes, I thought maybe we could just talk about the European Court of Human Rights and the fact that the Conservatives, despite David Cameron having said that after the result in Eastleigh he wasn't going to lurch to the right, there are now murmurings that they're going to do something about the ECHR. And I just wondered what we thought about this. Raphael, do you think, I mean, what they're saying is, my understanding is that they'll put this in the manifesto for 2015, that they can't do anything at the moment because the Lib Dems wouldn't have it, although there are some backbenchers who are now starting to murmur that they should try and push some legislation through and at least force the Lib Dems to vote against it to try and expose them or something. I mean, what are your thoughts about this? Do you think this is a result of Eastleigh, or do you think this was just going to happen anyway?
It's Chris Grayling is leading it, isn't it, with Theresa May. I mean, one thought that obviously occurs to me is, you know, people have been saying it for ages, but how abysmal is the number 10 grid management message delivery system. What is Craig Oliver doing that they put Cameron in an op-ed saying, I'm not going to lurch to the right, in the Sunday Telegraph? And if they did know, how stupid is it? And if they didn't know, who is running this thing? That also the Mail on Sunday was going to splash on, you know, we'll kill the Human Rights Act. You know, first of all, by all means, yes, it's the sort of thing you might have expected them to put in their manifesto. There are a lot of people who hate it. I don't think, in practical terms, Britain really wants to be in a position of, you know, lining up alongside Belarus as European countries that don't actually care about international human rights obligations. That all of the problems they have with the Human Rights Act are decisions made by British judges, not European judges, and those, by and large, and those British judges are reading in human rights law as it would continue to affect Britain, because we would still be a mature, responsible member of the international community. So it is sort of 99.99% angry, sort of chasing UKIP posturing. I think most people will see it as that, and it won't go anywhere. It might turn up in a manifesto, but more fool them if it does, to be honest.
What do you think, Emma?
I think that's just about right. I think again, you're absolutely right about the comms stuff. I mean, it's perfectly fine to have people who disagree with each other doing so in public, but to have try to face two ways on the same day is just makes you look stupid. And given that one of the key questions that's coming out post Eastleigh is Cameron losing control of his party, I think today's papers show that absolutely yes. Whether he can get it back or not is a bigger question, but he does not have his authority stamped on the party in any way. He cannot have. Well, he's saying one thing and two of his senior cabinet colleagues are saying quite the opposite in, you know, just on the same day. In terms of the policy, I think it's insane, but I'm very happy for them to be insane. I will campaign very hard to highlight that insanity and make it an electoral issue. I think that people hear Human Rights Act and think one thing, but if you actually break it down and break down some of the elements of that, people are actually quite keen on them. So you can totally say, well, did you know that the Conservatives are planning to scrap your holidays from work? Did you know that Conservatives are planning to double your hours? You know, that's the kind of campaign that will follow anything which is anything to do with them scrapping those kind of rights.
Mm. Well, we're going to be clear here about different, I mean, I'm sure we all know, but just to be clear, I mean, the EHRC is not a European Union institution. So, and they themselves are very guilty of sort of willfully conflating these two things. I mean, the reason they are, I mean, you can think, why on earth would you come out of a by-election sort of disappointment going on about something that is actually quite arcane in policy terms? I mean, I don't think people wake up in the morning and think, right, I'm really animated about the ECHR today. But actually, the Abu Qatada case in particular did cut through. My understanding of the polling and the Tory polling is that that case cut through quite well in terms of people getting very angry and thinking, well, why can't the Prime Minister do something about this? Why are there sort of terrorists roaming the streets that we can't chuck out? And that was quite a significant, quite salient issue. What is immensely cynical is when and journalists and politicians sort of glibly allied that with Europe more generally in terms of our relationship with the European Union. And if I've seen Chris Grayling do it before quite willfully. I've seen Theresa May do it. I've seen the front pages of national, mainly conservative leaning newspapers do it. And they will get away with it unless there is quite a concerted effort to call them out on it, because that's sort of appalling and shabby and generally degenerate as politics.
Well, that's why you need to look at the specifics of what it is that we'd actually lose if we were to scrap the HRA, which is what, I mean, they're for a start, they're unclear about what it is that they're planning to scrap, whether they will make us part of their negotiations with Europe coming out of the European Convention, or whether they'll scrap our own internal HRA, which is what signs us up to it, which is what internalises it in British law. They're not clear on that either. So at the moment, what they're doing is just floating some balloons to try and either win back UKIP support for the Conservative Party nationally, or more interestingly, try to source their own power groups within the Conservative Party for when the leadership challenge comes.
Or well, also, I think that's
what this is about.
Yeah, I'd never underestimate how sort of short term and tactically people think in politics. I mean, there's also between now and budget on the 20th of March, and the people need to keep the Conservative Party happy until then. So there are all sorts of things. It will be interesting to see how courageous Labour will be coming out and saying, don't be ridiculous, this is a noble piece of legislation, move on. I haven't seen much what the reaction has been from the Labour side.
It's a bit of a sticky wicket, this one, isn't it? I mean, I remember when there was the vote on prisoner rights, the right for prisoners to vote. I mean, when you boil these things down, they can kind of do a little smorgasbord selection, can't they, of things that they know won't go down well if they can spin it in a certain way with the public. And, you know, in the same way as Emma, you were just saying that, you know, this campaign could involve, you know, do you want to be, you know, be in a position where you're having to work loads more hours? I mean, the Conservatives can equally pick things that they can spin in a way that favours them. So, yeah, it will be interesting to see how that pans out, really.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's fair. And you know, Labour are not always as brave as they might be on some of these issues. I do get hope from how much they were willing to stick their neck out on welfare, which would be the other issue that the Tories were trying to, you know, make real red lines over, and actually to say, yeah, absolutely, we are actually going to take this on and, you know, really fight back on it. Hopefully they'll do the same with the HRA. And I think Sadiq Khan has actually spoken well about the HRA often. So it would be hard for him as the Shadow Justice Minister to actually reel back from that particularly.
I'd agree with that on Sadiq Khan, actually. I think he understands these issues and expresses them pretty well, and certainly has done in the past. And I don't think he would be one to lurch or get away with lurching or want to lurch into a kind of a reactionary pseudo-conservative position just to try and, you know, just because it plays well in a few focus groups.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think we probably need to draw things to a close there. So thanks very much, Raphael, for joining us this evening.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. And thanks, as usual, Emma, for being my co-host. And I'd also like to thank Audioboo, who very kindly hosts the podcast for us. And I'd also like to thank Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com for our theme music. And we'll be back soon.